This evening we have to bring to a conclusion our study of the bodies of man, and therefore we want to aspire at least to a rather broad survey of this subject. We've already mentioned casually in passing that the bodies of man correspond in the Indian philosophy to the corresponding bodies of the earth, or to the various fields of substances from which the bodies of man gain their materials and from which they are compounded in order that they may sustain the vital principle that gathers them on their proper and respective planes. In this regard, therefore, we are taught, at least by some of the Indian schools, that the bodies of the earth, corresponding to those of man, extend through the physical upward to the manasic field, or the plane of mind, and that level or body of the earth, which corresponds to the mental body of man, is the highest earth vehicle, and that therefore, from the substances of the earth and its various superphysical strata, these bodies are built, and that any person or being that enters into the manasic field, or into the plane of mind, or mind substance, becomes inevitably drawn to the earth, and becomes immersed in the earth materials. Therefore, technically, the term world or earth, as used in ancient philosophy, signifies not only the planet, physically, but these fields, up to and inclusive of the mental body. Together these form the sphere of mortality, and it is in the monastic field that the human ego, or the principle of self-existence, is generated and is maintained. Thus, the existence of the self as a personal being corresponds to the involvement of spiritual energy in a material condition. And if we include under the term material everything from mental substance through emotional substance, vital substance, and material substance, these four substances become the spokes of the mysterious St. Andrew's cross of antiquity, upon which the dove of Ixion, or the dove of Semiramis, the sole symbol, was crucified. Thus, the cross of body, which the Logos must bear, is composed of the four bodies, and these in turn are reflected downward into the four etheric fields to become the four elements. This picture gives us a certain grasp of the relationship of man to his world according to ancient belief. Now, in this great scheme of things, the world, or the earth, therefore, is represented in many mythological systems as a kind of surface in the midst of which rises a boss, like the boss of the shield of Achilles. And this boss is the mountain Meru, the abode of the gods. And this extends upward, like the Asgard of ancient Nordic mythology, or the Olympus of the Greeks, until its upper crest, the abode of the terrestrial deities, touches and pierces the mysterious sky that leads on upward into space, pointing with eternal finger to the constellation of the Little Bear. This concept of the world mountain rising in the midst of matter, of course, represents the gradual growth and development of man's vehicles, until the mundane god, which is himself, the ego, resides in the highest part of the world, which is the mountain Meru, or the ancient Hindu peak Kailasa. And here, the deity, surrounded by his godlings and attendants, exercises sovereignty over the material world and all the creatures that inhabit this sphere. Now, in the ancient symbolism also, this is the key to the story of Jonah and the whale. because Jonah, of course, representing Iona, the dove, or the soul, is cast over from the ship for disobedience to the word of God, another form of the fall of man legend, and falling into the sea is swallowed by the great fish. The great fish, of course, represents the mundane universe, extending from the mental sphere down to the material. And once the soul is held within this, it must remain the three symbolic days, symbolical of birth, death, and resurrection, or the three degrees of the mysteries, before it can gain liberation and return to fulfill its mission of preaching to the people of Nineveh. We have many similar symbols, and another that stands out for us at the moment is the work of the initiated poet Aeschylus, who in his wonderful poem, Prometheus Bound, describes the being that is bound in chains to the peak of Mount Caucasus, with a vulture placed above his liver. Prometheus, the provider, the provincial or the providential one, the one who was sent, who brought mankind fire in a hollow reed, was punished for his audacity by being bound to the peak of this mountain, from which he was finally rescued by Hercules, who of course becomes the symbol of the solar Messiah. All these legends and stories have to do, therefore, not only with the abstractions of cosmogony, but also with the development and generation of man. And a recent Indian author, in his study of the Vedic gods, explains to us that all these deities have their correspondences in the visible or invisible parts of man's constitution, that they represent principles within him, the discovery and understanding of which will provide him with the necessary keys, not only to the unfolding of scriptural writings, but also to the regeneration of himself. All of this brings us then to the next step in our problem. We can recognize in Indian philosophy these four bodies, or rupas, forming a kind of chalice or cup, called the cup of Lethe, and those who drink of it forget forever their divine origin. This cup, or crater, which receives into itself the blood of space, is also the Eucharistic cup and the cup of Gethsemane. It is the symbol of the involvement of life in form. And Christ asks that this cup be allowed to pass from him, but if not, the will of the Father be done, by means of which he implied death. And death was the ancient symbol of involvement in matter, for that is dead, which is buried within the mystery of body. Resurrection is therefore the restoration of the psychic or spiritual life of man from involvement in the chain of vehicles which constitute his personality, and which arise from the seat of individuality within his mental nature. Now, if each of the planets, then, is said to have these bodies extending upward to the Arupa Manas, these planets also have their existence within the great field of the sun. And here we have the second part of our Indian philosophy. According to these people, the sun contains within its power three tremendous spheres or orders of energy, spiritual life or being. And these are called in Indian philosophy the Atma, the Buddhi, and the Manas. The highest of these fields is the field of pure life itself, the Atma, from which we have our word Atme, meaning superior, or that which is best. We also realize that of these three fields, the lowest, or the monastic field, becomes the theater of lesser development. Therefore, the unfoldment of planets takes place in the third, or monastic field, of the body of the Logos. And within this field, which is the beginning of embodiment, all of the lesser vehicles are gradually individualized. The monastic field, then, is the third power of the Logos, or the third person of the great trinity of energies. And in the ancient triad of consciousness, intelligence, and force, the monastic field represents the principle of force. If Therefore, it be said that each of the planets only has certain vehicles or bodies ascending to the monastic field, the sun, or the solar power itself, the Logos, has the remaining vehicles which are necessary to complete the great septenary. Thus, in the ancient mythology, the higher vehicles of deity, or the higher bodies, Agni and Buddha, or Buddhi, are not peculiar to a planet, but constitute the common field of all planets. These, therefore, are a substance permeating individualized planetary evolutionary systems. And in the case of man, his monastic principle, his ego, is individualized. But if he transcends this or goes above it to a higher state of being, he is no longer within the sphere of body. Therefore, he passes into the collective psychic energy of the sun. Thus, man may have mental bodies individualized, but all men have the Buddhic sheath in common. In other words, we are now transcended the limitation of form, and we enter into the great field of life. To understand this perhaps a little better, I will try to make use of the famous symbolism used by the Egyptians, who described the universe by showing a transverse section of an onion. This represented a series of concentric rings, and in this system, Atma, or Atma, the supreme principle, is not in the center but at the circumference. And the rings, as in the stories of the Kabbalah, diminish toward the center, forming a concatenation like the rings of a bullseye target. The outer one, Atma, contains them all and corresponds in man to the principle of the auric egg, or the final vehicle which contains all others. Buddhi is within this and represents the great intuitional power of the Logos. Within this is the third, a monastic field, the world mind, within which gradually individualizes under the power of the so-called Cosmocrator, or the Zeus, the third power of deity, the mundane world and its diffusion comes into existence. Thus, each world contains all lesser than itself, and is contained in that which is superior to itself. Each of the planets with their vehicles, therefore, are suspended in the midst of this outer circle of bodies, which encloses them all, and in which they have a common sharing. Man, therefore, cannot actually build an individual or personal Buddhic sheath or vehicle, because the very principle of Buddhi, or soul illumination, corresponds not to an individual attainment, but of man reaching out toward universal re-identification. Thus, Buddhi represents to a degree the experience of cosmic consciousness, because in comparison to the planetary bodies, it is a cosmic body. More correctly, it is a solar body. Those who have attained it, therefore, are the sun heroes, or the solar men, the divine men and the immortal mortals. They correspond to the concept of the demigod, whose position is between heaven and earth. In the same symbolism, it is taught that from the principle of higher manas, or the higher mind, a bridge is built, a bridge upward towards that which is superior to itself, the experience of Buddhi. This bridge has been variously named and indicated, but it represents, of course, the seat of the universal soul in man, just as surely as his emotional nature represents the seat of the human soul. The universal or world soul is the Prometheus. It is also the Christos. It is the being which dies for the sin of the world. It is the symbol of illumination, which gives of itself for the redemption of the darkness below it. Therefore, Buddhi always represents, in the study of man, a luminous over-principle, a principle to which attunement or adjustment must be made by the powerful extension of the mind upward toward an experience beyond its own nature. Actually, the mind can never grasp the Buddhic principle for the reason, as we have told you before, no vehicle or no instrument can attain to the full comprehension of that which is superior to itself. Thus, as Buddhi represents also a paradisical world, a heavenly sphere beyond the state of mortal man, it is inevitable that mortal man cannot enter into it and can experience it only in one of two ways. First, by the transcending of his own intellect, and secondly, by what is called in Christian theology the act of grace, or the descent of the Buddhic principle itself through its adepts, arhats, and messiahs. This relationship then means that the search for Buddhi as an experience within the life of man is the search for the universal within and behind the particular of human experience. The Indian philosophers tell us definitely that the only road that can possibly lead to Buddhi is a road inward, that man can never discover it around him or in space, but he can experience it within him at the root and substance of his own being. The principle of manas, or mind, particularly the egoic vortex of selfhood, represents, so to say, the tiny bridge, or the tiny isthmus, which connects the upper and lower halves of an hourglass. It represents the constriction between an upper and lower state. Man ascending to the mind therefore ascends to a focal point, and from this point, if he continues to rise, he expands as a being toward the universal. And this expansion from the particular, from the individual, to that which is the root of individuality, and transcends it, is called the mystical experience. Now, in Indian philosophy, the mystical experience always represents, through samadhi, or through one of its various terms and names, man's momentary apperception of the eternal. We therefore have to understand a little bit about the nature and structure of Buddhi in order to estimate the meaning of the experience, and also the understanding of its relationship to Buddha, the man who is said to have been one of those who attained to this state of liberation. The nirvana is then, of course, actually man's release from the state of mental individuality, his ascent beyond the condition of selfhood towards that which is a universal nature or being. It is an ascent from the condition of a planet to the state of a sun. Now, what is the essential difference between a planet and a sun? The essential difference in the Greek and Egyptian and Indian philosophy is that a sun is a giver of life, and a planet is an acceptor of life. Man, therefore, living in the four bodies, which he has come to at least abstractly recognize, is a receiver of life. Into him pours the energy of the universe. Through him is distributed the vitality of the sun, the moon, and the planets. Also, through him pours the radiance and power of his own mental existence, the power of mind, the power of individual selfhood, which he has come to regard so highly. But man, for his sustaining and for his perpetuation, is forever dependent upon the world around him. He is dependent upon nature for the physical necessities of life. He is dependent upon the psychological structure of the planet for the psychological sustenance which he needs for his survival. And he is dependent upon the mind of the planet for the substances from which his own mental nature are generated. He is therefore forever a recipient, receiving, like the planets, from the sovereign bounty of the sun itself. The sun, however, is not a recipient. It is a bestower. And it is the spiritual duty, according to the ancients, of all men to gradually change psychologically from planets to suns. They must change from the state of receiving, from the state of dependence, to the state of giving, by means of which their own luminous light becomes the supporting power of other creatures. This great evolutionary motion, therefore, which they recognized, ends in sonship, either S-O-N or S-U-N, both of which have identically the same essential meaning, that they shall become radiant centers of life power. Now, in the Vedas and in the sacred writings, particularly the Rig Veda, which is the earliest, and therefore deals with the worship of elements and prayers to the sun, the moon, and the stars, in these ancient writings, the power of the sun was not regarded as being directed upon any group, class, or kind. The sun warmed all equally. The sun that brought forth the grass from the earth, and it brought forth the life of man. The sun is forever bountiful, forever bestowing, nor does it hold its gifts, nor reserve them for any favored few. It is the universal benefactor. Therefore, man attaining to sonship attains to the condition of the universal benefactor. Considering no longer any of the limitations imposed by Manas, he must achieve to the state of consciousness which is represented by Buddhi itself. And this state of consciousness is that of eternal diffusion of soul power. Thus the person, the being, unable naturally to completely disentangle itself from matter, and being to a degree bound by the laws of physical generation, cannot become identical with Buddhi or the world soul. He can, however, become receptive and responsive to its power. As long as his bodies remain, he must assume a receptive attitude and thereby allow the world soul to move through him, because he is part of the vehicles that survive only through receptivity, through acceptance to their own natures. And he has, however, the power not only to accept, but to disseminate, to radiate, to release through his nature these powers which the universe allows to move into him and through him in the course of manifestation. The purificatory rites, therefore, of the ancient mysteries, Eastern and Western, were intended to cleanse the inside of the cup, to make the bodies of man suitable to be the channels of Buddhi. And just as in the Indian system, the avatars, or the embodiments of God, take form and manifest in the world, so Buddhi, moving into manifestation through his purified disciples or instruments, is said to take form and to become incarnate in a regenerated creature, which by this reason and circumstance becomes a disciple or an instrument for the revelation of the messianic mystery. Thus, in Christendom, we also have this principle of Buddhi, or the world soul, the one and first begotten of the Father, representing not only illumination as such, grace as such, but also embodying another attribute with which the ancients most frequently endowed it, and that attribute was the beautiful. Thus, the principle of pure beauty is Buddhi. The principle of uncontaminated beauty, the principle of absolute order, therefore, absolute perfection, absolute harmony and rhythm, absolute harmonious motion, and absolute harmonious sound, all of these attributes are related to Buddhi and represent the emergence or the manifestation of the ecstasy of beauty, which has always been associated with the rites and rituals of the messianic tradition. Thus man becomes a channel for the pure beauty of God, and this pure beauty is a mysterious condition or substance, because the ancients regarded beauty not merely as a state, but as an energy, but as a principle and a power in life, for they refused to accept that anything which was of itself lifeless could produce life or change life. Beauty can produce life, and it does change life. Therefore, it must itself have a natural energy or power. It must be, as they called it, a blessed God, ruling with God over the universe. In the study of the Eastern philosophies, therefore, the essential ascent of man from the field of the monastic intellect to the Buddhic principle was through a series of projections or extensions of self. And these extensions of self were really not man forcing his way upward, but man achieving a peculiar kind of ascent through receptivity. In other words, he could not climb this rocky crest of Mount Caucasus where the crucified sun god awaited his deliverer. He was only able to become still within his own monastic field and experience the proximity of Buddha. He experienced this as the great peace, or the magnificent realization, as a tremendous flowing of a water of light through himself. Therefore, Buddha was also called the ocean which is above the firmament. This is the Shamayim of the ancient Kabbalists, the crystal sea of revelation that spreads out at the foot of the divine throne. It is also the source of the fountains, and it is also the root of the mysterious tree that bears the 12 manner of fruit, which is for the healing of the nations. Buddha is therefore the root of the God goodness which man experiences in his own ascent toward a more spiritualized state. In our Western life, we have great difficulty in trying to define or understand what might be termed a spiritual state for man. We think of heaven more or less as a place, as an abode of rewards, as a kind of blessed continuance in a state not different, essentially, from the one we know here. The East does not have quite this concept of it. To them, Buddha is not a participation in a place. Buddha is an experience of the omnipresence, omniscience, and omniactivity of the Creator. It is something which moves in upon man as a transcendent mood, something by which suddenly and indescribably he becomes aware of the sublimity of the great world that lies above and beyond him, the world which is the footstool of the eternal sun. We find Plotinus describing this problem in those moments in which, as he says, he had the experience of existing in the presence of a blessed God. These moments, the mystical experience of Havelock Ellis, these moments of transcendence seem to be man's promise, man's glimpse of the promised land of reality beyond him, the land to which he must sometime come, the Canaan of the redeemed. All of this undoubtedly contributed to the ancient discipline systems by which man sought to achieve a union or identity with the Buddhic power which enveloped him and within which he truly lived and moved and had his being. If then mind becomes capable of the knowledge of the good, which is its final experience, that which is above, within, and behind man, mind, becomes capable of the experience of the beautiful, that is, of actual participation in pure sublimity. This pure sublimity is naturally beyond definition. We cannot tell what it is. We only know, as the Greeks said, that we languish for lack of it. We only know that because we do not have it, we are less than we would be. Therefore, that this something, this additional power, is that which breaks for man the mysterious iron shell of mind and permits him to escape into a larger and more glorious existence. Now, the ancients tell us that due to the constitution of man and the peculiar way in which he is created, he is not able to extend across more than four conditions of substance at a time. Therefore, as he now extends from the physical through the vital and emotional and to the mental, This constitutes the complete gamut, or the cross upon which his soul is crucified. If then he would go on and attain to something superior to this, he must then lose or discontinue the lower vehicle. In other words, before he could live or polarize himself completely in the Buddhic state, he must transcend the physical form. That is the reason why in the story of Buddha, it is definitely and clearly stated that the Mahaparinirvana, or the great release, is only possible at the moment of death, because at that time, and that time only, man casts off the physical body. In the symbolism, of course, it is also taught that there are beings invisible to man who do not have bodies as we have them, and therefore are capable of a larger and fuller manifestation in the Buddhic state. Hierarchies and orders of beings called by St. Paul, thrones, powers, dominions, principalities, angels and archangels, therefore represent the creatures on the various rungs of the mysterious ladder of Jacob, the ladder which extends from the lower worlds to the throne of the deity. In the story of Buddha, then, for man, we realize that all evolution actually is toward Buddha, even as all involution is away from Buddha. All evolution is a motion toward the universal. Growth is always enlargement, either quantitative or qualitative. Growth of mind is the increase of mind. Growth of emotions is the enrichment of emotions. Growth of body is the extension of its powers and faculties. Always, therefore, evolution is a motion from limitation toward freedom. And in this great evolutionary motion which takes place in nature, this motion leads first from the material structure of man, upward and inward, through his vital, emotional, and mental natures, until finally he achieves the state of manas, or the state of man, which is an harmonious adjustment with the mental principle. Now, this is a bit optimistic, because on that basis we're not evolving quite as fast as we think we are. Actually, the word man implies that man is master of mind, whereas in practical experience the mind is usually master of the man. Instead of being able to control the mind or unfold its resources towards its essential purpose, man has become a servant of his own mental-emotional complex, and has therefore defeated the final victory which he is supposed to attain. Having made this somewhat serious error, man surrounds himself with the products of his own mistake. He therefore falls into a state of misery, misfortune, suffering, and comes under the dominion of the hindrances, as they are called by Buddha. All of these represent the punishments for the misuse of mental energy. And this misuse may extend into the arts and sciences and philosophies and religions. Wherever there is misuse, there is punishment. And this punishment is not inflicted by an arbitrary divinity, because the natural result of any activity is resident within the action itself. Therefore, nature simply punishes by consequences, by the natural and inevitable reaction of action. Man having theoretically, however, by evolution, attained union with the mental principle, reaches the greatest degree of self-existence. On this level of self-existence, he must make the determinations by which his future destiny will be governed. In the Eastern systems as well as in the ancient systems, man attaining to the state of mind must then survey his world, survey his universe, examine outwardly and inwardly, and bring all things knowable to man under the dominion of man. And in this dominion, there must be neither tyranny nor autocracy, neither abuse or misuse. For dominion in nature means always righteous rulership. And these things must occur, as is said in the book of Ruth, when the judges judged. This constant judgment by the mind is also the process described on the threshing floor. It is the dividing of the wheat from the chaff. It is the division of the sheep from the goats. It is man gradually coming to the right decision of that which is proper, necessary, and useful for man. This decision, when attained, results in the life of virtue. And without the life of virtue, man cannot proceed any further in his quest for the over-self. Always, therefore, each vehicle must be mastered before man can pass on to the next. And this is one of the difficulties that we have so often in religion, particularly in some of our more so-called progressive religious movements. The failure to realize that growth is through mastery and not through escape. That the individual cannot transcend any vehicle, power, principle, or energy within himself except through mastery. Now, we do not mean by mastery any mystical or mysterious term. We mean the simple problem of attaining to the right use of an energy, a power, or a faculty. For liberation always results from right use, from the fulfillment of the need or quality or condition implied by the faculty or energy. Therefore, to use correctly means to understand perfectly. And to understand and to use means to escape from the tyranny of that force or the limitation which that power might otherwise bestow. All limitation results from the failure of the mind to control the energy. Anything that is unknown to man is his master. Anything that is known to man, particularly known by the experience of consciousness, man is free from, and therefore is no longer in bondage to. Thus man, rising through the kingdoms of nature, from the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, and the human, ascends by the evolution of adjustment. He ascends by outgrowing, by achieving perfect harmony, and then extending beyond. And no one can extend beyond anything truly and completely unless that thing is first met, mastered, and understood. Therefore, in the growth of bodies, man seeking a higher state for himself cannot attain it until each of the lesser vehicles has enacted its toll. When Istar, the goddess, descended through the seven gates to visit Tammuz in the underworld, the keeper of each gate stopped her and took something from her. And if this was the price or the payment of going on, in the Egyptian rituals, the same was told, that those who passed through the various gates had to give something in order to continue on in their journey towards the Elysian fields. These gifts, this symbol of something that must be achieved or attained, always represents man's harmonious growth. It means that the individual has proved his merit by mastery. He proves his merit over his own emotions by mastering hate, fear, grief, worry. He proves mastery over his body by making it his useful servant, well treated but not human. He proves mastery over his mind by dedicating the powers of the mind to the end for which they were intended, that end being the common improvement of mankind. Thus, by right use, man gains as the mysterious payment which he must pay or give as he passes on into the next sphere of life. The old Christians, for instance, buried a coin with the dead to pay that the fare of the deceased across the river. Each individual must go not empty-handed into the next state of being, but supplied with the currency of that realm, which in each case is the currency of mastery, of adjustment, of ordered and integrated relationship with the principle involved. Thus evolution is man's gradual mastery of himself, very symbolically through the mastery of environment. But the mastery of environment is not enough. For the man who conquers himself is greater than he that taketh city. So all the way along, the bodies can only be transcended by the individual who understands them completely. For as long as mystery remains, man is the servant of mystery. And while he is the servant of mystery, he is a little mad. Thus, to attain final union with the mental principle, or to preserve or achieve the evolutionary apex of manas, the individual must have conquered all other lower vehicles than mind, and have brought them into harmony with the purposes of enlightened mind. If he has achieved this, he is properly termed sophos, or the wise. For wisdom is not a state of knowledge, but a state of achievement. Now, wisdom is more than learning, it is understanding. And understanding is that which results from the living experience of the fact. We have forgotten this in education. We have forgotten this in the policy of knowing that we have today. And as a result of that, we are producing schooled and educated persons who are still without understanding of themselves, the reason for themselves, or the world in which they live. Manas, having finally achieved its purpose, glorified and perfected mind, becomes, so to say, an appropriate symbol of the Demiurgus, or the third power of deity. For the mind or the intellect of the world is the third logos. And this power is the mysterious leader, the sage, the ancient Merlin, the archetypal principle of the wise man, the universal Plato, the universal Socrates. Thus mind in its highest aspect becomes the true philosopher, the true master of reason, who has discovered not only the power to control the reasoning faculties, but the reason why they should all be dedicated to the service of universal good. This mind born, this mind perfected being, this monastic creature, having fulfilled all that is less, having attained through discipline, through understanding, through learning, through growth, to a complete synthesis of the mental principle, then stands vested in the full garment of mind, or in the perfectly integrated and organized mental body, into which has been drawn all of the experiences of the lesser bodies, so that man as mind may experience emotion, may experience growth, may experience form, and yet as mind transcend all these things and remain truly a mental being. Thus, having reached this culmination without deficiency to restrain him, without inadequacy to limit his further progress, man then has available to him the total experience of mind. Now, the moment a human being achieves to the total experience of something in nature, he also achieves to a partial experience of that which is next. For mind, when completely perfected and completely integrated, is more than a totality, because out of its completeness there is another something of certain quality added. Therefore, we remember the words of the artist who said that when all things are of themselves complete, they are themselves plus completeness. And this completeness is something else. This completeness is man's capacity for a total experience. And all total experience on any level is in some ratio or symbolic sympathy to total experience per se, or in reality. Thus the total experience of Buddhi, the total experience of Manas is also the first experience of Buddhi. For the totality becomes the beginning of the next superior state. Thus, Only by total mind can the experience of that which transcends mind be actually achieved. Prior to that state, or to that condition, man may intellectually define Buddhi. He may dream of its existence. He may philosophically accept its reality. He may attempt to postulate its condition and even its attributes and phases. But until this totality of the preceding state is achieved, he cannot experience that which is next. Thus, the difference between theory and fact, between opinion and reality, this difference is clearly indicated. And totality becomes, so to say, a bridge which leads the individual toward the state of Buddhic realization. Now, philosophy, because it builds the mind, and because each of the bodies moves from the least to the most total part of itself by ascent, and the experiencing individual passing through evolution moves from the least to the greatest experience of its own being, so in each level there is an experience which is commensurate with the experience of Buddhi, but it is on a different level. And this experience occurs in each case in the sixth level of the vehicle. Thus, mind divided into seven parts, or seven levels, has within its sixth level what might be termed the foreshadowing of the Buddhic state, even as it has in its seventh level the foreshadowing of Atma, the true or total existence. Thus, a great philosopher or a great mystic attaining either to the sixth level of the emotional nature or the sixth level of the mental nature will have the experience of Buddhi on that level. In other words, he will have the experience of universalization, because this is the peculiar experience of Buddhi. Universalization is the motion of the thing toward the infinite, towards a return to an unconditioned state. And in the case of man's various levels, we can perceive the workings of this even on the physical level of society. For instance, human society ascends on seven levels, and on the sixth level it corresponds to the experience of Buddhi. And on the sixth level of human society, we have this experience in what we begin to dream of as the concept of one world, which on a physical plane is again the concept of unity or union. We are now experimenting intellectually and even politically, for the first time seriously, with the concept of the total brotherhood of mankind. We are experimenting with the idea that was so magnificently expressed in the rise of our own national existence, namely that all men are created free and equal. We are experiencing the experiment. As individuals, few totally believe it. Still fewer have experienced it beyond the level of a conviction. And yet, what happens? We gradually perceive around us the dark mist rising as they rose around the funeral pyre of Hercules. We know that unless man achieves a universality of his own concept of civilization and culture, that he is threatened with extinction. He realizes that gradually he must either discover one world or have no world. This is a symbolic expression of Buddhi on the level of social existence. Now, as man gets further into the emotional world, he finds other parallels. He finds the concept of universal love. He finds what Jesus taught, namely that if we love or do good to those who do good to us, there is no great credit for so to the scribes and Pharisees, If, however, we can do good and love those who despitefully use us, this is different. And gradually love rises from the personal, which includes first only the self, where in many cases it stops at this time, but extends onward also to love of family, to love of children. A certain type of very personal and selfish affection draws a little circle and includes within itself those small numbers of persons, family, clan, brood, those that are near. Then gradually love expands to take into itself the stranger outside the gate. And by degrees man gained love of country, love of God, and the willingness to give his life, if necessary, for a devotion more than personal, more than human, and gradually tinctured with unselfishness. Thus we see the emotions reaching their Buddhic level. We didn't mention the vital body, but perhaps we should pause and do so, because here also we are moving away from the old concepts and toward the realization of total energy. We recognize more and more that vitality also ascends until we experience a common reservoir of life, and that we must adjust ourselves with this reservoir, or else we will perish. That unless the energies within our own bodies are brought together in some relationship more important than the mere gratification of the various instincts and impulses of the moment, that the individual will be sick, and that a universal life principle demands universal obedience. So even on the level of energy, as in the case of atomic energy, we are beginning to recognize energy as one thing, one tremendous force, upon which all things depend, and which by appearances may be divided, but in substance and essence is indivisible. So little by little, on every level, evolution carries us to the realization of that which is above analysis, for it is the nature of the mind to analyze or divide. And it is only in great wisdom that the mind is able to reconcile the divisions which it has fashioned itself and bring them back again to the concept of unity. So as we ascend, we come in every level to the significance of Buddha. And in the most practical and purposeful levels of our physical endeavor, we learn of the importance of unity in industry, unity in trades and professions and crafts. Trade unions are formed, associations created, in order to have mutual protective movements of all kinds. The experience that each must work with the other for the common good. And yet through all this experience, constantly beating in upon him, the average man remains, as he has always been, a rugged individualist, utterly unaware that his very individuality is the cause of the various miseries with which he is so heavily burdened at all times. So all these things are shadows of Buddha, the long shadow of the wing of the eternal. And everywhere the lesson is the same, that we must gradually outgrow division, that we must outgrow separateness. And strangely and wonderfully enough, we must outgrow this peculiar sense that strength is our own. We can no longer depend upon this rugged strength within us, this strength which is peculiarly personal. We can no longer live in a universe by will alone, battering down obstacles for the puny resources of our own natures. We have discovered that no matter how we fight or how long we struggle, we are as though struggling against a great sea which will ultimately close over us, and we will leave not a rack behind. Thus, man's rugged personal desire to survive is causing him gradually to realize that as an individual, as a separate entity, as a completely isolated creature, he cannot survive. For isolation is death on every level, whether it is isolation of the mind, isolation of the emotions, isolation of the physical life. That which loses communion with its fellows dies. For nature has worked and is working constantly to bring things together and to cause all separate natures to be reunited. And the string or thread that binds these natures together like the nosegay of Michel de Montaigne is nothing but the thread of mind, a gentle string that holds the bouquet into one pattern. The mind is not the flower, it is only the string. Thus, then also, in going on, we come to the total experience through the unfoldment and perfection of the emotional mind, psychic powers, of the total need of ourselves for the total experience of life. Buddhi corresponds in a mysterious way to our term light. It is the Ein Sof of the Kabbalists. For in Kabbalism, there was a threefold universe, one part of which was boundlessness, the second part, boundless life, and the third, boundless light. In the Indian philosophy, Buddhi corresponds very closely to the concept of light. Not the light of the eyes, but the universal light. You remember in the story of the golden ass of Apuleius, the candidate for initiation into the mysteries was taken into the grotto, and in describing afterwards what occurred to him, he said he saw the sun shining under his feet at midnight. This is a very peculiar statement, but was intended to imply that the ancients were already well aware that the sun did not go out at night. That the sun did not vanish, nor was it swallowed up, nor did it actually descend into Hades to light the souls of the dead. It does that when it rises in the morning. The sun forever shines. But what we call day and night are due to the mechanical processes of the motions of the earth. Therefore, what we call light and darkness are not due to changings within space itself, but in relationships between life and form. And while form imposes itself between life and light, then there is darkness. But when form no longer imposes itself, the eternal sun can be seen at midnight as easily as in the middle of the day, according to the old Greeks. This concept of Buddhi, therefore, is a kind of living light. It is the kind of light that permeates all things with the quality of making everything visible. Everything that is revealed in its true and natural conditions.